It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. After the 2018 midterms, the day after, joining us for this bit of analysis, Donna Hoffman, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Ben.
Chris Larimer, also professor of political science at UNI. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Ben.
And we have a lot to talk about this hour. We want to invite our audience. We know you tuning into this program, we're tuned in to the results yesterday evening. Share your reaction to our 2018 midterm results. Any questions also that you have going forward? What are you celebrating? What are you lamenting? What do you think this election means for Iowa's future, for the country's future? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. History-making results at a state level, also in our congressional elections. Let's put the congressional results off to the side for the moment. And if we could, Donna and Chris, talk about the election of Kim Reynolds last night. She became the first woman ever elected to the governorship in the state. Here she is speaking from the Republican election night watch party in Des Moines.
We have a great economy, one of the strongest in the country. Our wages are going up, our taxes are going down, unemployment is at a record low. The budget is balanced, the reserves are full, and we have a $127 million surplus. That's a state that's working. Well, we all know we're the number one state in the country, so that's a good place to be. We're rated the best place in America for middle-class families. Our farmers are the most productive anywhere in the world, and our cities are thriving. Together, we have accomplished so much, and Iowa is moving in the right direction. But you know what? We are just getting started.
First woman ever elected to the governorship in the state. That's because she was appointed up to this point after Terry Branstad became U.S. ambassador to China. So a historic moment for us, Donna Hoffman.
Certainly. She was serving as lieutenant governor. And when Terry Branstad went off to China, she became the governor. She'd had a relatively short tenure. But she had amassed a little bit of a record and certainly was running for election in her own right and was able to do that last night.
Chris, three of four of Iowa's congressional seats now in the Democrats' hands, or will soon be when the next Congress reconvenes shortly. How do you have three of four congressional seats go to the Democrats, but a Republican win the governorship?
Well, it's a really good question. It's one I'm still trying to kind of unpack a little bit. Just looking, you know, the Des Moines Register has a nice set of maps up there where you can look at county by county results and see any differences. And just looking at the map for governor, Governor Reynolds won 88 counties. Fred Hubble won 11 counties. But then if you start to compare those to the results in congressional districts, you see some differences. So, for example, in the first congressional district up here in Cedar, where we are in Cedar Falls, Abby Finkenauer won Winnesheek County. Fred Hubble did not. In the second congressional district, you know, Dave Loebsack won Cedar, Muscatine, and Wapello County. Fred Hubble did not win any of those counties. And then in the fourth congressional district, you know, he had J.D. Scholten winning Woodbury, Webster, Boone, Cerro Gordo, and Floyd as the counties that he won, but Fred Hubble did not. So in each of those congressional districts, Fred Hubble underperformed compared to some of the Democratic candidates that actually won. And so I think there's probably you're gonna need a little bit of time to go back and kind of figure out what happened there. Were there differences in campaign strategies? Were there differences in voter outreach to try to understand why Hubble did not perform as well as some of the congressional candidates in those districts?
Donna, what are your thoughts on this point?
So another way to look at this, not that Chris's is off, it's excellent, but another way to look at this is to take all the people in Iowa, because everybody had a ballot for a House member, everybody had a ballot for the governor. Take the number of people who voted for a Democratic House member in the four congressional districts. That gives us 657,000 votes. Hubble got 623,000. So there were people who voted for a Democratic member of the House but didn't vote for Hubble. So we have people splitting tickets, obviously. That's not necessarily Anything new in the state? I mean, ticket splitting, usually we talk about it a lot more than it actually occurs, but we have some here, obviously. But what we have that's somewhat unique in the state of Iowa are those no-party voters. And those no-party voters, you know, 38% in the first district, for example, are really key to how those congressional district races will flesh out. And they may not always be voting a straight ticket. And at least some, you know, we don't know if it was no-party people or Democrats and Republicans. But generally speaking, if you're a partisan, you're more than likely to vote a straight ticket. It's those independents who in polls or in those no-party voters who not only in polls but in our voter registration will not indicate that they're Democrat or Republican. Now, we know research shows that most of them are closet partisans, but at least a certain percentage of them aren't, and they tend to be pretty critical in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would say that's a good point, right? We do need to understand those the level of ticket splitting that's going on in Iowa, because the trend nationally is certainly that voters within both parties are becoming more entrenched, that they're less likely to be open to you know, any sort of persuasion from the other side. And so the fact that we still do have voters who are, or at least seem to be, splitting their ticket, going through the ballot and voting for Democrat for one office and Republican for another, is quite interesting given the hyper-partisanship sort of atmosphere that we seem to be in.
Mm-hmm. And our new election law here in Iowa really enabled this, didn't it? This is the first election in the state that did not allow straight party voting in one fell swoop by marking one box, right, Donna? Could that have something to do with it?
Correct. So that was the hope of reformers who passed this, is that we would make voters be educated, in which sense the notion was that they would look at candidates individually rather than voting a straight party ticket. However, you know, we need to understand that voting a straight party ticket's not irrational, because partisan party means something. But it certainly is the case that voters in this election could have voted a straight ticket, but they had to manually do it all the way down. And so there could have been a little bit from that. But, you know, generally, I think in the previous midterm election, when you could straight ticket, I think about 30%, as I recall, did that. You know, so it's and one of the problems with the straight party ticket voting is that you tended to get some undervote in terms of retention elections and that kind of thing, because the partisan, any nonpartisan election wasn't covered in that. Mm-hmm. And so potentially not having that straight party voting helps with the undercount on some of those races, but that remains to be seen.
Let's do some quick hits going to the phones, getting some reaction from Iowans. Your reaction to the midterm results, 1-866-780-9100. Stephen in Iowa City, what is your reaction? What is your comment? Welcome to the program. Okay, Stephen, click. That's his reaction. Peter in Des Moines. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Hi.
Here's my reaction and my comment. I was extremely disappointed that Fred Hubble did not win. We have a governor who signed legislation that effectively harmed women. She's a woman governor, and she signed laws that harm women. I mean, that's as illogical as it gets, but she's controlled by a political party that has enslaved itself to corporate interests, and she can't stand on her own and defy her own party.
Mm-hmm. Okay. View from Peter in Des Moines. Thank you very much, Peter, for your view. Kim Reynolds, the one view, of course. There are many other views about the election of Kim Reynolds. I wonder, when we look at, do we have the breakdown, Chris, in terms of male-females voting in this particular instance?
You know, I haven't seen it yet. Mm-hmm. I think, but Peter's question's an interesting one, because it's really asking, you know, are voters really issue voters? Were there issues that motivated voters to vote for one candidate or the other? And you know, that's a tough question to get at. Again, you know, I think partisan politics is, you know, looking at someone's party ID is still going to be the number one predictor of how they voted. I think, as with any of these races anymore, they become nationalized in the sense that they get caught up in national politics. So you probably had a lot of, you know, there was probably a significant chunk of voters who were going to the polls based on sort of their feelings about the federal government, kind of their feelings about the country, their national mood, any sort of level of anxiety that they had. And then those issues at the state level, so whether it was Medicaid, taxes, tax cuts, collective bargaining, voter ID laws, You know, those are probably more mobilization factors and mobilizing and motivating voters to turn out at the polls rather than persuading them to vote one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. Iowa's chief executive became the first woman elected governor of Iowa last night. She will continue to govern with a unified Republican majority in both legislative chambers. Donna, what does this mean? This means the GOP agenda continues here in Iowa.
It does. So the Senate stayed in Republican hands, as did the House, although Democrats cut into their margin just a bit with a pickup of about five seats, I believe. But one of the things, if we look at, you know, what I think this means going forward, Chris and I both have done some research on Iowa political geography, and in particular, the urban-rural divide in the state. And I think we see that exacerbated. I mentioned this last night, but it was pretty late, so probably not a lot of people heard it. But
I heard it. I was driving home. It was great.
Oh, well, excellent. Polk County, typically we can look at that and kind of see how Democrats do there, because Democrats want to run up the percentage there. And we saw Hubble do that. He got about 58% in Polk County. But it wasn't enough. And when we look at the counties that Hubble won, he won seven of the 10 largest counties. And nothing essentially west of I-35. All of that's on the east part of I-35. So this election in the past, Kim Reynolds only getting about 40% of the vote in Polk County would have signaled that she wasn't doing enough there. But she was able to pump up her percentages probably in those rural counties, more rural counties, and those counties in the western part of the state to overcome that deficit. And so I think in this election, when we look at it more thoroughly and we analyze it, we'll see perhaps that urban-rural divide, which has been present in Iowa before, actually probably got exacerbated in this particular election.
Okay, let's move to the other history-making results.
I wonder, I was going to say, on that point, too, I think with Governor Reynolds, I think what's going to be interesting is the next 2 years. You know, in terms of public policy theory, there's an argument for what are called policy windows, and it comes from the work of John Kingdon, a political scientist. And he argues you really need kind of public opinion and the what he calls the political stream to kind of come together to push for significant policy change. Well, an election is part of that political stream coming together. And so you had a significant election last night where Governor Reynolds is elected as Republican governor and Republicans retain unified control. But as Donna said, that rural-urban divide is very clear when you look at the map. And so looking out to 2020, my guess is that Republicans are looking at the 2019 session, the 2020 state legislative session as their last – potentially their last 2 years to really finish off whatever policy agenda they want while they're in power.
Mm-hmm. Democrats taking control of the House of Representatives as we switch our focus to the federal level. The U.S. House of Representatives adding several women to their ranks, including two Iowa women who toppled incumbent men from their congressional seats. Let's hear from one of them in the first district. Last night, Abby Finkenauer became one of the first two women to represent Iowa in the U.S. House of Representatives, as well as becoming one of the youngest people ever elected to serve at that level in any state, 29 years old. Here's a good chunk of her acceptance speech from Seven Hills Brewing Company in Dubuque.
This campaign has always been about hope. Hope and the idea that if you work hard, you're not just able to make a living, you're able to have a good life. Hope and the idea that your kids or your grandkids can get a good education and do better than you did. And hope in the idea that, God forbid you get sick, you don't have to file for bankruptcy. And hope that if you come from a small town in Iowa, from a working class family, you can have a bright future just like I did, just like every single person in this country deserves. Hope is the reason we got this far. Hope is the reason we still have a heck of a lot of work to do. You asked me to be your voice in Washington, D.C. And you have my promise that I will work my tail off every single day to make sure that the Iowans that Washington has clearly forgotten are heard very loud and clear.
Abby Finkenauer, last night, her acceptance speech, she will remove, displace Rod Blum, Congressman Rod Blum, who sought his third term in Iowa's 1st District and become the 1st District's first Congresswoman representing Iowa in Washington. Looking at the tally there, 51% Finkenauer and Blum, 46%. What made Finkenauer's candidacy so successful?
Well, again, I think part of this was caught up in just national politics, a frustration with the direction of the country, a frustration in part, and we don't have all the exit poll data yet, but certainly a frustration with the Trump administration. We saw Congressman Blum, sort of cozying up to the Trump administration throughout the campaign, not really shying away from President Trump, sitting next to the president when he visits Piazza and so forth. And so I think part of that is national politics. Some of it is also just enthusiasm within the Democratic Party for a young, energetic candidate and someone they felt like could change things. And that is a historical candidate. In her own right, as you said, as being the first woman from Iowa, along with Sidney Axne last night, is elected to the U.S. House of Representatives. And so I think some of that's just the national mood. And again, we're kind of waiting on all the exit poll data to understand that.
Mm-hmm. The national mood, the Trump factor, but also Governor Reynolds elected, even though she very closely identified with the president toward the end of this campaign, Donna Hoffman. What do you think of the Finkenauer candidacy?
Well, obviously both with Finkenauer and Axne picking up those seats and Lobsack holding his, of course, changes that 3-1 Republican ratio to 3-1 Democratic to Republican in our House delegation. But here's an interesting thing. So, you might look at the results that Kim Reynolds won the state and that Democrats did really well at the federal level, and that is true. It is, one of the things I think I'm seeing here is that voters in Iowa are able to distinguish federal or national level politics from more state-oriented politics. And so there you have potentially some voters, this is speculation because I don't have any exit poll data here, but some voters in the state perfectly willing to vote for a Democratic House candidate, maybe not approving of the Trump agenda in some ways. But at the same time, being able to distinguish about state Republicans. We haven't talked about the other statewide races in Iowa because there were some other ones, and I think three of those went to the Republicans, three of them went to the Democrats. So Iowa has always kind of done that balancing act, and we saw it. So I think you have voters distinguishing federal-level politics, state-level politics, maybe not everywhere across the country, but I think in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. And I think Donna's point is really important because I think that's one of the things I'm trying to figure out. And if I look at last night, one of the things I think of is that in part this was a win for political science. And I know political science really got taken to task after 2016, but Donna's right. If voters in Iowa were distinguishing between state and federal level sort of economic conditions when they're going through the ballot, that's what political science predicts. And on the on the other point too, thinking about just overall about the U.S. House, there's a political science model for predicting the outcome of midterm elections by Alan Abramowitz, and in his model he predicts that if Republicans are down about 7 points on the generic ballot test as they were going into last night, they should lose about 27 to 30 seats. And right now it looks like they've lost about 27 seats, and there are several races still outstanding. But so far, last night's results fit with what we have learned from political science. So I think in part it's a win for political science.
Okay, let's hear from the other history-making woman, Cindy Axne. Here she is touting her PAC-free funding and promising to serve the people of Iowa in a bipartisan Congress. Cindy Axne's 3rd District acceptance speech from the Democratic Election Night watch party at the Embassy Suites in Des Moines.
I talk to Iowans about their struggles for affordable, quality health care, for jobs that can give our families opportunity, and for our seniors to be retired with dignity. And one thing is clear, Iowans are working incredibly hard, we're playing by the rules, but Washington doesn't have our back, And we deserve a heck of a lot better, don't you think? Well, I plan on changing that. And as a matter of fact, I'm interested in solving problems and making sure that we bring opportunity to the people back here in our corner of the state and to this entire state in general. And because of that, I have not taken one penny from a corporate PAC because I'm out there to work for you. And not for corporations and special interests, because this has always been about us here in Iowa. And I can tell you, when I'm in Congress, I will support any bill that helps the people here in our state. I'm not going to support something just because it's a Democratic bill, and I'm not going to support a bill just because it's, oppose a bill just because it's Republican. I will support any good idea as long as it helps the people here, the folks in our corner of Iowa, the best district in the state, Iowa's third district.
Democrat Cindy Axne in her acceptance speech last night, much closer than the Blum-Finkenauer race here. Cindy Axne, 1%, 49% to 48%, a 5,000 vote difference, approximately. Donna Hoffman, what's your read on how this turned out? David Young, a different candidate than Rod Blum, but still losing here by a slimmer margin.
Right. And, you know, one of the things that Young and Blum both have in common is they were both competing for a third term. Blum in particular was not particularly a good fit for that district. But the third district in particular is very, very evenly split, literally a third, a third, a third, Democrat, Republican, no party in terms of active voter registrants in the state. And David Young's pretty low key in terms of his campaign style. And he was endangered in his previous election, but did end up winning that, as did Blum. But this cycle just proved too much for both of those incumbents to survive, and they got swept out on that blue wave. Now, we might talk about that blue wave because people are debating whether there was a blue wave or not, and maybe we can talk about that in the second half of the show, because regardless, if you're a partisan, you have something to crow about in the results of this election.
Indeed, we will talk about it. Donald Trump ripping Republicans who defied him. He says he stopped the blue wave. We'll talk about it. And the interesting 4th district race, Steve King, escaping J.D. Scholten there to win another term in Congress. Please join our conversation with Chris Larimer and Donna Hoffman, 1-866-780-9100. What are you celebrating? What are you lamenting? What do you see in the future? 1-866-780-9100. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment. We're back with the Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The day after the 2018 midterms, Donna Hoffman with us of the University of Northern Iowa, along with her colleague Chris Larimer, our political scientist, picking apart the numbers. There are numbers that will be dissected for weeks and months to come to find out how we got the results that we did to our first elected female governor in Iowa, Kim Reynolds, and also two women elected to the House of Representatives from Iowa for the first time in the 1st and the 3rd District. Let's talk about the 4th District here to start off this second half hour. Early in the evening, it looked as though we were going to have an upset, didn't it, Chris? J.D. Scholten challenging the 8-term Republican Steve King in the 4th District looked as though he was stacking up quite a lead.
It looked like that early on, but of course we had to wait till all the precincts were reporting. But he certainly, as I mentioned earlier, J.D. Scholten outperformed Fred Hubbell in the 4th Congressional District. He won several counties, including a couple of the urban counties. He won Cerro Gordo, but as I mentioned, he won Floyd, Boone, Webster, and Woodbury, counties that Fred Hubbell did not win. And so I think, you know, for J.D. Scholten, he made this a race that was considerably closer than Congressman King is, I think, accustomed to. I think there's still some speculation about whether or not Congressman King did himself any favors in terms of some of the rhetoric that was on display at the end of the campaign. Those are things we still don't know a lot. We still don't know yet the extent to which that really mattered, because I saw some exit polling data last night that suggested that it was a pretty even split between voters who said that they knew who they were going to vote for all along versus voters who made their decision along the way of the campaign. But in the case of the 4th Congressional District, you had a very polarizing candidate and an incumbent in Congressman King. And I think for most voters in that district, they had an opinion of Congressman King probably before the campaign started.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear a little bit of Steve King from last night. King crediting his supporters in the 4th District of Iowa for his narrow 3,000-vote victory.
Our whole card was this. You. You knew the truth all along, and you guarded my back. You guarded at the coffee shops. You guarded at the dinner table. You guarded at a church. You prayed for this campaign. And that's the margin, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's
right.
Margin's prayer.
That's right, yeah.
In fact, I think we might have lost in a landslide if it hadn't been for prayer.
Okay, Steve King from last night. Interesting that Steve King had some disputes with the press at the tail end of this campaign. Several papers that I know of, the Des Moines Register was denied access to Steve King's campaign, calling the Register a leftist propaganda media outlet with no concern for reporting the truth. End quote from the Steve King campaign. Storm Lake Times, also in that district, excluded from covering this gathering. Also, an editor at the Weekly Standard denied access. They had been shooed away. It reminded me, I wanted to play this little cut from Art Cullen. He is the Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial writer from the Storm Lake Times. I spoke with Art Cullen. This is from back in September on a visit I made to Storm Lake. But I asked him at that time about the appeal of Steve King, and here's what he had to say.
So people here react to Steve King's brazenness, and they like it because he's kind of flipping the bird to the world. And a lot of people around here, including me, might like to flip the bird to the power centers in New York and Washington also, because we feel that people aren't really representing us out here in rural Iowa, and that the solutions that have been pushed on us from Washington and Des Moines have only resulted in more depopulation, less farm income, less rural vitality. And so I think everybody here says, hey, we're fed up with this. And here comes this radical right-winger who's willing to tell the world to take a flying leap. And people find that attractive, and I think that's what they found attractive in Trump. It's kind of irresponsible, in my view, but I understand it. I want to tell the world to take a leap, too.
Art Cullen, Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial writer for the Storm Lake Times. What do you think of that analysis, Don Hoffman?
Yeah, I mean, I think that rings true, in particular when you extend that to Trump. I mean, we even know that many of the supporters of Trump will, when asked, say, you know, Trump says it like it is. He says things that others won't say. And that's one of the aspects that they think is useful. And so King is very much in that mode.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Nick in Des Moines. Nick wanting to talk about Steve King's success. Welcome to the program, Nick. Nick, are you there? Nick in Des Moines, giving you one more shot at it. Sorry, we can't connect for, I think, a technical reason. Well, let's listen to a little bit of the president. He's been reacting this morning, of course. Did you expect something different? Donald Trump reacting in his speech, speaking at the White House this morning. Trump discussing bipartisanship, including what he expects to see happen when Republicans and Democrats can negotiate infrastructure and health care.
It really could be a beautiful bipartisan type of situation. If we won by one or two or three or four or five, that wouldn't happen. And the closer it is, the worse it is. This way, they'll come to me, we'll negotiate. Maybe we'll make a deal, maybe we won't. That's possible. But we have a lot of things in common on infrastructure. We want to do something on health care. They want to do something on health care. There are a lot of great things that we can do together.
Okay, Donald Trump today sending out other messages as well. Chris, what do you expect as far as the new landscape for this very unconventional president?
Well, I'd first say that there's been a lot in common on infrastructure going back to his election, and really nothing's been done on that. But in terms of moving forward on divided government, it's a political calculation at this point for the Democratic Party, the extent to which they really want to go after the Trump administration, engage, start the oversight process, ramp up the oversight process, because now even though we don't like to think about it, really today everyone's starting to think about 2020. What does this mean for 2020? How do they play out the next 2 years in terms of going after the Trump administration versus working with the Trump administration? As I said, that's a political calculation based on what they think they can get done and how that affects their expected electoral chances in 2020. So I still think we're waiting to see what that process looks like. But they're very much trying to understand, because they don't want to overstep. For the Democratic Party, the danger is overstepping in terms of going too far with an investigation that ends up mobilizing a sort of a backlash effect that they experienced then in 2020.
Mm-hmm. Donna, you agree?
Well, you know, I think the Democrats cannot be seen as being obstructionists. Now, that in fact is a strategy that worked for Republicans under the Obama administration. And so I think, and Nancy Pelosi, I still think she's going to be Speaker of the House. She's very savvy. And they will do their constitutional obligation of investigating various aspects of the Trump administration. That's part of the checks and balances system. But I also think she will engage, especially on things like health care, potentially on things like infrastructure. That doesn't mean they'll get anything done, but they can look like they're engaging in that regard. And they want to run in 2020, whether it's House races or potential presidential candidates, on being able to solve problems. So they need to look like they're engaging on those problems with the Republicans. And again, maybe nothing will come of that, but they need to show that they're doing their part to engage and try to push Republicans to counter them on that. And that gives them then a foil if they want to run in that way. But they don't come off as being obstructionist in terms of we're just going to investigate and we're not going to do anything else.
Mm-hmm. Chris, in the Senate, Mitch McConnell's life just became a lot easier. He doesn't have to thread the needle, so to speak, so often. And we've heard in the news that the judiciary is his focus, right?
Yeah, that sounds like it's what is going to be the focus, that they're going to focus on confirming more judges. That's been a relatively slow process at this point, but they're trying to speed it up. And again, you know, back to Donna's point, really this is, you know, you're going to have to figure out how these two chambers are going to work together, where they are going to try to find areas of cooperation, where there is going to be disagreement, where the Senate is going to push back hard on what the House is trying to do. And again, I really do think it's a political calculation going forward for 2020, because the map for the United States Senate changes, it essentially reverses from what it was this election cycle. This election cycle, I believe it was, you know, 34 seats up, Democrats defending 25 of the 34. Essentially, that flips, and I imagine Donna knows the numbers on this, but essentially that flips where Republicans are going to have a tougher time on the ballot going into 2020. And they're going to be a little bit more on the defensive. So that little bit of cushion for the Republicans right now is something that they're going to have to think about going into the next election.
Okay, let's go back to our phones. Nick, a different Nick than we had problems with a moment ago. Hopefully no problems with this Nick from Des Moines. Hi, Nick. Nick, are you there? Okay.
Hey, Ben, how you doing?
Good. I thought we had a ghost in the machine, but evidently our technical side is working again. Welcome to the program, Nick in Des Moines. What do you want to raise here?
I'd like to know how it came about that Iowans voted to change the federal house, but yet we couldn't vote to change either the Iowa Senate or the Iowa House or governorship.
Mm-hmm.
And create a more equitable political system here in Iowa.
Nick, in Des Moines, I think we're going to get back, Donald, right, to this no straight party voting here that seemed to be on display.
Well, right, and that ability apparently of Iowa voters to distinguish the federal level from the state level. You know, Iowa tends to like their incumbents, even though two incumbents got voted out at the federal level. But when, you know, we're talking about incumbents who are your neighbors in the state house or state senate, those ties sometimes are things that cause people to cross party lines, for example. And we should still say that Democrats did cut into the margin in the Iowa State House, improving their take there about five seats.
I think Donna's earlier point about the rural-urban divide is really important here. I think if the caller, Nick, has a chance to look at the maps on the Des Moines Register website, look at the one for the Iowa House, and that rural-urban divide is about as clear as it gets for the 100 House seats. And so what happens is, you know, you have those House seats in the Iowa House that where you can see where Democrats are picking up those urban districts, but then there's a disconnect between picking up an urban House district versus picking up, you know, an entire urban county, as we saw in the congressional races, where they can you know, build up the votes in those counties, but then, you know, they're trying to offset what's going to happen in the more rural areas. And so if you look at the Iowa House map and then look at the map for the first congressional district, Abby Finkenauer won just four of the 20 counties in the district, but she won three of those counties in Black Hawk, Lynn, and Dubuque by a large enough margin to offset the losses elsewhere. But once you get down to the smaller level in the House districts, it's easier to see why some of those are going to go Republican.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to our phones. If you've just joined us, Chris Larimer, Donna Hoffman with us of the University of Northern Iowa, our political scientists analyzing yesterday's midterm results. Sharon is with us in Des Moines. Hi, Sharon. What do you want to talk about?
Yes, I just have been thinking about an argument actually against early voting, especially this cycle with what came out with Kim Reynolds not distancing herself from Stephen King. And I can't vote against Stephen King, but that was the ultimate decision on why I would not vote for Reynolds, was because she could not distance herself from Steve King's rhetoric.
And your point about early voting?
Yeah, that those things that happened very close to the elections, that Kim Reynolds would not disassociate herself with Stephen King's rhetoric and especially his anti-Semitism.
Okay, Sharon, let's get a little analysis. Our hours are running out here. So Chris, perhaps you can tackle early voting. We had, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think from 45 days down to 30 days under the new Iowa election law, 30 days of...
Yeah, I think it was maybe 40 down to 29 days.
To 29, okay.
Yep, yep.
In the ballpark. Okay, so early voting, so you can have, of course, people's minds change in the beginning. Undoubtedly, people out there who voted early and then would have voted otherwise had they waited till election day, right?
Right. I think there are a couple points here. One, I think the questions really getting at the extent to which sort of campaign events matter or in particular, you know, this notion of an October surprise. And Donna and I have had this conversation several times, whether there really is such a thing as an October surprise. And particularly now, given that voters seem to be so entrenched within their own political parties that the likelihood of voter persuasion is as small as ever, at least according to a lot of research, you know, whether those things that happen at the end of the election cycle really matter, I mean, there's a real question there. The other side of the argument, of course, is that are voters really updating their beliefs along the way? I think it was in the 2012 presidential campaign, and Donna, you can correct me on this, where we had early voting, and essentially there was one presidential debate before you could start voting, so you didn't even get to see the other debates. And so there's a question on how voters make up their minds. Are they really open to being persuaded because of something that happens in October, or really have they decided before the campaign even starts?
Right. We shouldn't dispute that pull of partisanship. You know, there used to be a phrase in the American lexicon called the yellow dog Democrat, meaning that if the Democratic Party ran a yellow dog, that's who they'd vote for. Now, that has kind of gone out the window, but that aspect of partisanship there rings true. For the people who are early voting, there's nothing that's going to happen, generally speaking, that's going to make them want to wait and see to election day.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about quickly before we go another surprising event, an upset here in the Midwest, closing out one of the tightest gubernatorial races in the Midwest. Educator Tony Evers unseated Scott Walker to take over the governor's seat in our neighboring state of Wisconsin. Here's Sean Johnson of Wisconsin Public Radio discussing Evers' victory on Morning Edition today with NPR's Steve Inskeep.
Tony Evers has been in education in one form or another for years. He's been Wisconsin State Superintendent of Public Instruction for three terms. He was a superintendent, a principal, a teacher before that, and a very mild-mannered guy. I mean, kind of soft-spoken. Not exactly somebody who is known as a great orator or debater, but wore that educator label very, I guess, proudly in this race, and stressed that in his ads that he would be different than Walker when it came to education. His other big issue was healthcare in this race and talking about pre-existing conditions, and that's something you heard in the Senate race, too.
Let's underline for people who may not recall that Scott Walker battled with teachers' unions and battled with Democrats over education throughout almost his entire tenure as governor.
Absolutely. And he's actually, as we talk today, has not yet conceded in this race. It's within about 31,000 votes and raised the prospect that, you know, he may continue to fight this in some kind of a recount, although that's a big margin to overcome.
Donna, comment on this. A monumental figure here in the Midwest, in Wisconsin, Scott Walker reshaping Wisconsin in so many ways. Education mentioned there. Also a one-time presidential candidate, now out of his governor's job.
Certainly. And so that was one of the things that was certainly in a race that we were watching. But the fact that Scott Walker went down, Democrats did well in governor's races. They picked up seven of those. Another one to talk about is Kansas. You had a similar kind of figure, Kris Kobach, to Walker, in that the left tended to really take exception to some of the actions of those individuals at state levels. And the Democrat won Kansas. And the woman who won the Democratic race in the Kansas governorship, also kind of like Evers, like we heard Evers described there, where you had Democrats not doing as well were those more liberal Democrats in the South, Beto O'Rourke, and Gillum in Florida. We'll see what happens with Stacey Abrams. I know I'm conflating some governors and some senators there. The point being that in the upper Midwest and in some of the plain states, you had Democrats running these kind of non-offensive, middle-of-the-road type candidates, and those candidates did pretty well, and those aren't the only two examples.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, one thing about having, after such a long time, such a long campaign, having the midterm election here finished as of yesterday, dissecting the results, is we get to take a breather. Okay, there's the breather. Now let's talk about the 2020 presidential election. To finish off our program, Chris, you saw my little act coming, I think.
I did.
What does this mean for the 2020 presidential race?
Well, I think if nothing else, it shows that Iowa is a swing state. And this is something that Donna and I have talked about a lot. But I think this shows that Iowa is a very competitive state. The rural-urban divide, as we've talked about throughout the show, is very clear. But it's also clear that Democrats and Republicans can do well in Iowa. Donna mentioned earlier, you know, Rob Sand winning the state auditor's office. But you also have, you know, a Republican elected as Secretary of State, Secretary of Agriculture, and in other high-profile statewide races. And so I think for 2020, it becomes very much an open contest, at least on the Democratic side. And we'll see on the Republican side whether or not someone would really actually challenge a sitting president.
Mm-hmm. John in Urbandale is really interested in 2020 as well. Donna, what can you say?
Well, I knew you were going to ask about this. So just back of the envelope, I calculated the number of Senate Democrats who potentially might be coming to Iowa. There's about nine of them. And that's about one-fifth of the Democratic caucus in the Senate. And that's just the senators. And, you know, and we'll see what happens on the Republican side as well. But certainly, you know, one of the things we can take away from the 2018 election results is that Iowa will matter again in 2020, because we're not a red state. We're not a blue state. There's competitiveness there. And because we're first, that will be something that will garner us a lot of attention from those candidates, mostly Democrats, but maybe even some of the Republicans.
Do you think that with the president having now a real foil in terms of a democratically held House of Representatives, does that strengthen him in 2020? Can you make that argument, Donna?
I think that's an argument he probably will make. I think it remains to be seen how he how that dynamic works out. And I'm not clear on how potentially that will work out. But certainly I don't see Trump changing his stripes or not being combative. And he always wants a foil, because that helps him in the us versus them kind of bifurcation that he tends to put most situations into.
Mm-hmm. Chris, your view on Donald Trump in 2020, he will continue to be as he has been these first 2 years. He won't reach deep down inside and find a deep bipartisan inner self ready to come out?
No, I don't think so at all. I agree, completely agree with Donna. It's going to be a very combative kind of that us versus them, in-group, out-group rhetoric mentality going forward, trying to shape up the 2020 election as you know, everybody's against him and they need to rally around him.
Okay, very good. We've run out of time. Thank you so much for our first glimpse, our first analysis on Politics Wednesday of the 2018 midterm results. Chris Larimer, professor of political science at University of Northern Iowa. Also at the University of Northern Iowa, professor of political science Donna Hoffman. Thank you both for coming into our studios today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you. You're welcome.
River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Help today also from Alyssa Bovinette. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Come along for an honor flight tomorrow to Washington, D.C. with 100 veterans. We'll hear about it tomorrow on this program. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.